Good evening. My name is Bryce Stevenson, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the 2010 A Food Odyssey Learning Community, and the First Year Seminar Program, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, Activism, Education, and Gastronomy in Italian Slow Food Chapters. Founded 20 years ago, the Slow Food Movement is a growing international grassroots food advocacy coalition which emphasizes the practice of good, clean, and fair food practices. The movement advances these practices through involvement in local slow food chapters, which aspire to increase consumer food awareness, defend food biodiversity, connect producers and consumers, and promote food and taste education. Our speaker tonight, Carol Cunahan, is a professor of anthropology at Millersville University. Dr. Cunahan's research centers on food, culture, gender, and identity in the United States and Italy. Cunahan has authored several books and has edited various food-related literature. She's been a visiting professor at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy since 2005, and during spring 2009, she began a new ethnographic research project on food activism in Italian chapters of the slow food movement. Her research and analysis of slow food chapters and members awards us insight into the advancement of food activism and its effect on achieving social and economic justice and change. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. In addition, the first annual harvest market will be held on Sunday, October 17th at the 2 Mile House from noon until 6 p.m. This event is sponsored by the Cumberland County Historical Society and the Green Room Bistro and Juice Bar Restaurant. Tickets are required and all are welcome. For more information, please contact the Historical Society. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming Carol Cunahan.
Thank you, Bryce. Am I wired and on, ready to go? Everybody can hear me? And thank you to the Clark Forum and to the learning community, the Food Odyssey Learning Community, for bringing me here. Okay. As you can see, the title is Activism, Education, and Gastronomy in Italian Slow Food Chapters. And what I want to do today is talk a little bit about food activism, about food democracy, define these terms, and then tell you a little bit about my research, ethnographic research on Italian chapters of the slow food movement, which Bryce just gave you a very quick definition of. Thank you for that. And then last, really look at the role of education, which is a big focus of slow food in Italy, and try to think a little bit about the role that education plays in activism. This slide shows you one of the slow food earth markets, or Mercati della Terra, in Bologna, which is one of the ways that slow food is trying to promote good food and education at the same time. The working definition I'm using for food activism is the process of advancing social and economic justice through food practices. It is also involves promoting democratic alternatives to the global agri-food system. A number of examples range from very individual pursuits, like being a vegetarian or practicing freeganism. Freeganism involves trying to get food for free through things like dumpster diving, gleaning, going into fields after the harvest and picking up whatever food is left. Gathering foods, people go into Central Park in New York or out into the countryside in Pennsylvania. Gathering foods, this is all part of freeganism. CSAs, I believe you know about, community-supported agriculture, because I learned at dinner tonight that Dickinson has a farm and promotes the community-supported agriculture where you buy a share at the beginning of the growing season, get food throughout the growing season, and support the farmer with an assured income. Urban and school gardens, like this garden here in Prato, Italy, It's an orto scolastico, or a school garden, that was sponsored and founded by Slow Food in conjunction with the Tuscan region. Buying groups is a big movement in Italy. They call them GAS, Gruppo d'Acquisto Sociale, or Solidaritas, sorry, Gruppo d'Acquisto Solidale, or a Solidaritas buying group. Community kitchens, we have Kathleen Schroeder's work on community kitchens in Peru, where a bunch of women get together, pool their resources, buy food together collectively to benefit from cheaper prices, and then rotate the cooking, sharing the work and sharing the food. And of course, farmers markets, Food Not Bombs is another kind of anarchic alternative food movement, food activism effort. Food Not Bombs proponents gather foods or glean foods or pick up discarded foods at supermarkets, cook a vegetarian meal, and then give it away for free with a big Food Not Bombs sign. Obviously making a political statement at the same time as making a food statement. Via Campesina is an international organization of food producers, or sometimes called peasants or campesinos, and of course, Slow Food that we're going to talk about today. So that's food activism. Food democracies, closely related concept. We can use Tim Lang's definition. Food democracy is where all citizens have access to culturally appropriate food, meaning food that fits in with and satisfies cultural traditions, healthy food, sustainable food, and affordable food. Another definition of food democracy that I really like is Neva Hassanein's definition. She suggests that food democracy is when all the voices of the food system are represented. And so this would mean producers, consumers, rich, poor, distributors, farm workers, and so forth. Everybody literally at the table. This slide here is a slide I took at Terra Madre, which is Slow Food's biannual meeting of food communities. Takes place every 2 years in Torino, Italy, and is taking place next week. I've been to the last two Terra Madres and decided I just couldn't make it this year. It's a long way to go for a five-day conference. But what Terra Madre does is bring food producers, academics, youth, and chefs from all over the world. It's almost, it's kind of like the Olympics. It opens with a march and people from all over the world with their country flags. And you can see them here in this slide. They come together to try to promote the goals of Slow Food and come up with an agenda for promoting social justice and food democracy. And by the way, the figure on the screen is Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food. Some things to think about have to do with what some are calling a politics of consumption. Sidney Mintz, the father or grandfather now of food anthropology, said in one of his writings, people can become different by consuming differently. And we have ample evidence of this from anthropology and from history, from our own lives. We make choices about what to eat, which express different facets of ourselves. But my question is, by consuming differently, can people change the world? Can individual choices about consumption bring about broader social change? Can they create political coalitions? And really, this is the premise on which Slow Food is based, that people can change the world by consuming differently. But I think it's an open question. And this sort of practice of trying to change the world through consumption falls under this definition of what some, like Neva Hassanein, are calling new social movements. Movements to change the world, not through unions or, you know, proletarian marches in the streets, but rather by changing lifestyles, changing the symbols that we use to represent ourselves, or changing our identities. And I think this also leads me to another question: is there such a thing as middle-class activism? Can there be a movement to change the world that comes out of the middle classes? Because, of course, traditionally, if you take a Marxist perspective, social change has to come from the working classes. So to what extent are people who have a lot to lose going to propel change in the world? These are some questions that I want to think about today and also ask you to think about. So again, another photograph here of the Mercato della Terra, or the Earth Market, in Bologna, which is, of course, a forum through which people can begin to change their consumption. Slow Food got its initial start in 1986 when the first McDonald's opened in Rome in the Piazza di Spagna, or the Spanish Steps. It kind of got its real name, Slow Food, in 1989, was founded in Bra, Italy, which is the home of Carlo Petrini and his band of brothers, who were 60s radicals who sort of cut their teeth in the student protest movements of the late 60s and early 70s. And one of them said to me, we burn out on politics and thought we'd have some fun and do food. And all of a sudden, before we knew it, we're back in doing politics again. As Bryce said, Slow Food's mantra and motto, and I think this is truly a brilliant sort of public relations mantra, is good, clean, and fair food. Good meaning tasty, local, nutritious. Clean meaning produced sustainably without pesticides and toxins. And fair meaning produced under fair conditions with just compensation for workers, people who work in our food system, and fair prices for consumers. Today, Slow Food has around 100,000 dues-paying members in 130 countries. Most of those dues-paying members are in Italy and the U.S. Other countries are less well-represented, and has many more kind of aficionados who are not dues-paying members. So I don't think the 100,000 number fully represents Slow Food's impact. The members are organized into chapters, which are called condotte in Italy and convivia everywhere else in the world, convivium singular or convivia, except in the U.S., where Slow Food USA recently decided convivia sounded too esoteric, and so we're now chapters in the U.S. This group is some of the members of Slow Food Ravenna, a town in Italy. Every chapter of Slow Food has a sort of nucleus called the Piccola Tavola, the little table of organizers, and then a bigger group of members who attend their events. It is the chapters that try to foster Slow Food's goal of good, clean, and fair. As you can see, this is me interviewing Angela Ceccarelli in Ravenna. During spring semester 2009, I was a visiting professor at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy, and I started this research project interviewing chapter leaders and members of several Slow Food chapters using the so-called snowball method, which is you kind of roll along and find your interviewees where you can. I was able to do these 38 interviews recorded with my little digital recorder there and then transcribed into about 500 pages of transcriptions, which I am slowly starting to work with. So this is still pretty preliminary. This idea of recorded interviews comes out of my longstanding interest in the food voice, or food as voice. My previous research in Italy, which resulted in the book I wrote down here, Around the Tuscan Table, Food, Family, and Gender in 20th Century Florence, and then my more recent project, Tortillas Like Life, Food and Culture in the San Luis Valley of Colorado. These are both two projects where I collected food-centered life histories. These are interviews with willing participants focusing on beliefs and behaviors surrounding food. Basically, anything and everything to do with food, that's what I ask people about. And my goal in this is really kind of encapsulated in the title of a book that was put out by the Latina Feminist Group. And their book is called Telling to Live. And basically, this was my goal, to collect stories from people who had not really made it into recorded history, whether they were ordinary Florentines, who were the topic of my book Around the Tuscan Table, ordinary Florentines, not Machiavelli and Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, people about whom we've heard a lot, but just plain ordinary Florentines. The people I interviewed for A Tortillas Like Life are Mexicanos or Mexican Americans in southern Colorado, the part of the Hispanic community there. So my past research was really looking at food as a voice, predominantly of women, but also of men, to talk about family, gender, and kind of domestic life. And what I've gotten interested in now is food as a voice and practice of activism. So sort of shifting the focus from the domestic sphere to the public sphere and using the same method of collecting people's stories about food. Now, slow food wants to transform the world. This is what Mauro Bagni told me. Noi vogliamo veramente trasformare. We really want to change. We really want to change the world. We really want to transform. And so my question is, are they succeeding, and what role does education play? And I started thinking about this, Marx's third thesis on Feuerbach, where he says what you see here, circumstances are changed by men and women, and it is essential to educate the educator himself or herself. And this really seemed to resonate with the work of Slow Food. Marx goes on, the coincidence of the changing of circumstances and of human activity or self-changing can only be conceived and rationally understood as revolutionary praxis. So Marx here, I mean, this is a very little kind of pithy statement, but seems to be getting at this dialectic between changing the self and changing the world. And it seems to me that this provided an interesting framework to look at the work of these people that I was interviewing in Slow Food. It also resonated for me with the work of the Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci, who spoke about the organic intellectual. The organic intellectual is different from the sort of typical university-educated intellectual. In Gramsci's framework, the organic intellectual is the person who comes out of his or her class and represents the interests of the class in a kind of forward-thinking way. And so clearly, the organic intellectual is someone who is educated in a different way from a typical, what Gramsci called traditional intellectual, but someone who through education becomes a leader. And so what about people like Giorgio Pirazzoli here, who was the working with Slow Food? He was the market master of the Bologna Farmers Market. And he's there talking to my husband, and I love this slide because it really, it's like, there he is, educating my husband about what they're doing at the Slow Food Market. So how are they using education, and does education of self and other change society? That is the question. So let's talk a little bit about the kinds of education that Slow Food is promoting. First of all, they're trying to reach all ages, adults, youth, and children. So here I was at Slow Food's big fish, I don't know what you'd call it, exhibition event in Genoa in 2009. And here was a very sort of typical didactic experience. They're teaching the kids about endangered fish. One kind of education that Slow Food does is about production and biodiversity, about farming or fishing or animal rearing and the relationship between production methods and the improvement or lack thereof of biodiversity. Sensory education, learning to use the senses in a much richer and fuller way to appreciate food and drink. Cultural education, because, of course, food and culture go hand in hand. So if you want to keep food going, you need to keep culture going, and vice versa. And lastly, what I call commensal education, or revitalizing the knowledge about the pleasures of the table. So let me just give you a few examples of this. A big initiative of Slow Food are these school gardens called Orti in Condotta, or gardens for every Slow Food chapter. And ultimately, this is Slow Food's goal, to have a school garden for every one of the 320, 330 chapters that they have in Italy. And you can see, or maybe you can't see, but on this map, it's a map of Italy, and it sort of lists how many school gardens there are in various regions of Italy, from 49 in Tuscany to 2 in Calabria. And this picture here on the right is, again, from Ravenna. And these were children from the Orto in Condotta there in Ravenna. They had a garden in their school. They then harvested the produce and brought it to the farmer's market. So all kinds of educational processes are, of course, going on, from learning about how to plant and grow and what plants are like as they come out of the ground, how they taste when you pick them off the vine, how you sell them, how you make change, the whole thing. So they're learning both about production and about taste and smell of really fresh local produce. The earth markets, Slow Food also wants to start popping these up all over. There aren't very many so far. I think there are 6 or 8 actual markets sponsored by Slow Food. And they are not only about education, obviously, they're also about providing markets for producers. But while you are there at the farmer's market, which you can see here on the left, behind the market, that round building, that's the Cineteca, or the film library, film forum in Bologna. But all of the producers there are educating while they're selling their products. So the gentleman on the top on his cell phone, behind him, there's a little sign that says, "It's not only bread," and then more about the weed and the smell, and he's giving you samples. On the lower right is Stefano Fogacci, a farmer who is raising cattle, a special kind of typical cattle of the Modena area. And he had prepared these little trays with different kinds of cheeses made from the milk of this cow and some sauce, some ragu, made from the meat. So you get sensory education, education about producers, and education about biodiversity. Oh, wait, one other thing. What you're also getting is you're educating people about where to get good food, because the producers are there. You're establishing what they call la rete, or the network. Okay, so another thing Slow Food does is organize visits to farms. This is Stefano Fogacci's farm in the countryside near Modena in Monte Ombrado. This is a 16th century farmhouse. On the top right, you see a kind of heirloom cherry tree that is typical of this area and produces cherries that are only produced here. In the lower right is a photo of his barn. You visit, you learn, oh, so this is how people raise cattle when they're not factory farming them. There's cows, there's ducks, there's a dog, there's a goat. And this is his heirloom cow called the Vacca Bianca Modenese, or the White Modenese cow, that he was showing to you in the earlier slide the products of. Slow Food also does on-site farm education for school children. On the right is Rosalella. She is a retired school teacher who went back after she retired and sort of started working the family farm called Masseria Ferri. This is in Puglia in southern Italy. Those are Trulli behind her, a kind of typical architectural structure of Puglia. On the left is the flyer that she kind of distributes, trying to get schools interested in bringing children to her farm. On her farm, she will teach the kids about the cattle that she raises there, the grapes that she raises and turns into wine, the cheese she makes, and she also had an oven and got the children involved in making bread. And again, so you get all kinds of sensory experiences by visiting the farm, by making the bread, and of course by smelling that wonderful, delicious odor of fresh bread. The producers are also often present at the dinners. What people in Italy called, oh yes, la classica cena, the classic slow food dinner. And this, I think, is the part of slow food that may be most well-known to people and that may arouse the most disdain. Because a lot of people think of slow food, they think a lot of rich people getting together, eating really esoteric, expensive food. That goes on. I mean, at these dinners, you will get a chance to try amazing things to eat. But you may also get to know the producer. So Rosalella, whom you saw on the previous slide, was here at this dinner. This was a slow food dinner. Her products were there. She was talking to us about the products. We were all sitting around getting to know each other. So we had the joys of commensality, of eating together. And we're eating, smelling, tasting, and developing our sensory awareness. This is another example. This is one of my favorite kind of beautiful food slides. What you see on the left is a palette of honey. This was actually a university class at the University of Gastronomic Sciences. So the slide here on the right, these are all in English, and what they say is they tell you what each different kind of honey is. These are like single malt honeys. Each honey is made from one kind of flower. So we have acacia, starting on the left, acacia, rhododendron, lavender, sunflower, dandelion, linden, fir, chestnut, and strawberry tree. And it's, to me, it's like so beautiful the way they have arranged these on the palette. And then you taste each one. you hear from the producer. This little drawing over here is a drawing of the radius that bees fly, which is, I guess they fly about a mile radius. So if you move the hives and stick them in the middle of a dandelion field with dandelions for all as far as the eye can see, you'll get dandelion honey. I never knew that there was like single flower honey. I never knew that. I never knew that honey could taste as different as these honeys taste. So they also do these Master of Food classes where they will do three or four classes on tasting and learning about how to produce wine, spices, coffee, beer, cereals, and so forth. And you will taste and learn about the producer and learn about the culture of those foods. Last, cultural education. This was a cookbook that was produced as a result of a concorso gastronomico, a food contest or a gastronomic contest in Calabria. They have a contest every year around a theme. This year it was legumes. Local people make their favorite legume recipe, bring it, there's a big event, they give a prize, and they end up publishing a cookbook. Therefore, the idea is people are learning about the foods of their culture. They are learning how to make them. They are learning about all the different legumes that maybe have gone out of use. They're providing a channel for these things to continue. So, many kinds of education. What are the results of it? It was clear to me that the people who work for Slow Food were changing. They all talked about how much they were changing, how much they had learned. They learned to taste. They learned about foods they had never known. And they learned how to get these foods. They also made incredible connections. So it's a very social, socially based movement. Because in Italy, of course, food and other people go together. And I put this slide here of Daniela Rubino and Carlo Casti because they became a couple as a result of their work with Slow Food. She was the head of the Milan chapter. He was head of the Lombardy region for Slow Food, and they got together as a result of Slow Food. Let me just mention specifically a couple of people that I talked to. On the right is Noemi Franchi. She's a young woman, 26 when I interviewed her, who was working actively for a Slow Food chapter. And I give you the Italian, but I won't read the Italian, just the English. She said, "For me, Slow Food has been essentially the discovery of a reality I didn't know existed." Incredible opening up of her mind, of her life, of her experiences. "It has enriched me both on an educational plane and especially on a human plane." So you see her there at a Slow Food event with her new friends. The event that she got involved with was this wine extravaganza called Figli di un Bacco Minore, or Children of a Minor Bacchus. What this was, is an exhibition of wines of lesser-known grapes. And I went to the website. This is just the grapes that they had on hand in the form of wine from one of Italy's 14 regions, Emilia-Romagna. Look at all those grapes. Now, we've all heard of Sangiovese or Cabernet. These are tons of grapes that maybe we and the people that came to this exhibition had never heard of, had never tasted. So they make these available and try to promote taste, education, biodiversity, quality, and price. So what Noemi said to me was, look, the recuperation of old traditions and native grapes produces commercial success for the producer. gustatory success for the taster, and success for biodiversity. This is the translation, obviously. She also went on to say, look, if you're trying to promote biodiversity in food, local foods, good, clean, and fair foods, get people to taste them. This is how they know. And what you end up with when you come away from an exhibition like this is, as she said, a much more complex reality. It's no longer, oh, I'm in Emilia-Romagna, it's Lambrusco. No, you have 20 or 30 different kinds of wine that you now know about. And so she kind of concluded by saying, look, to learn to teach is fundamental to me. And I love this because she's getting at the reciprocity that you know, I think Marx is hinting at in the third thesis on Feuerbach, that reciprocity, to learn to teach. Learning and teaching go together. Another woman, Daniela Cassi, she was in a very small slow food chapter in Zibello near Parma. She said, look, people want to know. They want to know, but they don't have a means of knowing. When people know, they appreciate. And again, maybe this is a typically Italian way of thinking, but basically, people want to know more about the foods they're eating. Where are they going to find the knowledge? Slow food is going to educate them. People seek quality, she said, not quantity, but quality. And quality must be explained. What makes a good prosciutto? What makes a bad prosciutto? What makes Parmigiano Reggiano special and different from Grana Padano, for example, a lesser kind of Parmigiano? And lastly, she said to me, and I bolded it here, I learned, but others also learned. And for me, this is the most important thing. So through her work with Slow Food, she's constantly accumulating knowledge, but she's also teaching and spreading knowledge. So, what about, it's clear to me that people who work with slow food are changing, but are they changing the world? And as I thought about this, I realized I can't really answer this yet, because when you're an anthropologist and you do recorded interviews, you're getting people's presentation of self. They're telling you how the world looks from their point of view. What does the world look like around them? I think to do that, you have to do participant observation, our other key tool in the anthropologist toolkit. So it's one thing for me to interview Piero De Rico sitting in his study. It's another to go out and see what slow food is doing. And so that's what I'm going to do. Next semester, I'm going to be a visiting professor at the University of Cagliari in Sardinia, Italy. And there, I want to continue interviewing slow food people that I started interviewing in 2009, but I want to extend my own net and look at the entire alternative food movement, not just what slow food is doing, but what other people are doing, and see how they're all fitting together. So I want to look at the whole alternative food movement networks and ask the question, are all the voices of the food system present? What are the voices, and are they all there? And to that end, I'm particularly interested in gender, because, of course, we know that women and food go together, that women have a major responsibility for food in the home. What about outside the home? What about when food goes public and becomes a form of political activism? How do the gender roles play out? And, of course, in slow food, this is a very important question, because one man said to me, slow food è maschilista. Slow food is male chauvinist. This panel here was the sort of head table at a conference of slow food. It was a conference in March of 2009 of representatives from all the chapters all over Italy. And on the first day, everyone at the head table was male, except there was one woman. So there was grumbling in the crowd. Well, the second day, they put a lot of women up on the head table. It was clearly They were tokens because they had no role, but they were responding to the grumbling. And so when you go from private to public, in Italy in particular is the field that I'm asking about, how does gender play out? And as Noemi Franchi said, look, the slow food woman is tired of hearing talk about the hearth, tired of hearing talk about the magic of the kitchen. She wants other things. And in my opinion, the slow food woman can point in new directions. For example, towards education. This is an example of male-female roles. You have the woman doing the work of making, she was making pasta here. You have the man explaining what she is doing. Are all the voices of the food system being heard? Another question that really, I think, needs to be tackled head on. Can slow food in specific and the alternative food movement in general successfully challenge the global agro-food system? So I have on the left, Terra Madre, Slow Food's big conference. On the right, we have McDonald's in Italy. Does the one have the power to challenge the other? And we'll see. And maybe you have some comments on this. Another question. Can slow food improve security for the world's 1 billion hungry people? Estimates are today there are 1 billion people in the world who are food insecure, who do not know with security where their next meal is coming from. There are over 35 million people in the U.S. who are food insecure. Is slow food, is this process of education, of taste, and education about biodiversity and producers, can those efforts actually work to solve the problem of world hunger? And in particular, can these efforts that are very Italian, that are grounded in Italian cultural reality, contribute to global food equality? Just to conclude, who cares? Why is this important? Why is the work of slow food important? Well, as Raj Patel said, food activism is the world's largest social movement. And I have noticed in the half century that I've been teaching, that's a joke, almost half century that I've been teaching, the real resurgence or surgence of interest among students in food activism over the past 5 to 10 years. So there is a lot of activity to change the world through the food system. Slow Food Italy is at the vanguard of this global movement. And I was very excited to see recently that the U.S. is starting what is now called a Food Corps. This is an AmeriCorps program. Possibly you know about AmeriCorps, which is a one-year volunteer program. The Food Corps is under construction right now, but it's set to launch, I believe, in January 2011. And its goal is to build farm-to-school supply chains, expand food system and nutrition education programs, and build and tend school food gardens. And the website, this is the entry page for the Food Corps website, and of course the first thing they ask is sign up, but if you look down here about us, you could see that the 5 founding members of the Food Corps, these 2 here on the right are both slow food activists. One is currently working for Slow Food, Jerusha Klemper, and the other used to work for Slow Food, Cecily Upton. So clearly there is interest in and a space for food activism, even here in the U.S. where this all didn't start. It is a significant social movement, and I would now be delighted to take your questions. Thank you very much.
Hi. Earlier you mentioned that to join the slow food movement, there is a little fee that you have to pay. Does that ever exclude individuals who can't afford that fee? Or I don't know how much the fee actually is from the movement itself.
I am not sure. I know that it's a there's a discounted fee for students. Something like, I think it's about $25 for students to join, and it's $60 for adults, non-students. You can certainly get involved with Slow Food without paying a membership fee. You might wonder, well, now, why do I have to pay this fee? Well, the fee goes to support the activities. For example, the school garden project. Before you can start a school garden, you got to have some groundwork. You got to know what you're doing. And so what Slow Food does is they send out an educator from the national office to, let's say, you wanted to start one here in Carlisle. They wouldn't send somebody all the way from Italy. I don't know if Slow Food USA does this. I imagine they do. But somebody comes and works with the local community to get the garden going. Well, that person is paid. So that's a job for somebody, so it's a good use of money. But the money does go to support the Slow Food's efforts. It also goes to support the national office, where they have a staff of, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 people working in Bra, Italy, to promote Slow Food's agenda.
Has the U.S. chapter been very successful? Is it practical for people in the United States?
Yes, I think it's. I think Slow Food USA is the second biggest representation in the Slow Food movement. And clearly, I mean, they have managed, I'm not sure, I haven't followed all the details of how Slow Food was able to get this food core going, what role Slow Food played, but they seem to be quite activist, more focused on the production end than on the tasting and sensory education end. Or I think it depends on where you are. But yeah, I think it's. I think a lot of exciting things are going on. You may have heard about Slow Food Nation in San Francisco. Was it last Labor Day or a year ago? I don't know. Time has collapsed. But there, it's so much depends. I mean, this is one of the questions I ask people in my research. Slow Food is an all-volunteer organization, except for that 30 or 40 people who are working in the national office in Bra. So you have a volunteer organization. What you get done depends on your volunteers. So when I was in Italy, I was living in Parma, home of Prosciutto di Parma and Parmigiano, right? Really important food area. Well, the Slow Food chapter, alas, was dead. Nothing was happening. You know, my plan was I was going to join the chapter and get involved in the activities, but nothing was going on. Ravenna, you saw a bunch of photos of Ravenna, a bunch of photos of Bologna, lots going on because they have a very active group of volunteers. So we have a chapter, actually, we have a Lancaster York chapter of Slow Food that is also moribund, or how should I say, dormant. It's not dead, but it's asleep. So nothing much is happening in our chapter. It's a very active Philadelphia chapter that is constantly doing events. A lot of them so far have been eating and drinking events, but they're now slowly focusing on more activist, typical activist type of things like starting school gardens, starting farmers markets, promoting community-supported agriculture and such. Other questions?
Hi. Do you see the slow food activity as an invisible hand in social movement against fast food or communal farming supported organization?
Could you ask that again? I didn't quite catch what you said.
Do you see slow food activities as an invisible hand in the social movement, like against the fast food, or do you just see it as a like community farming just support organizations?
Did you say invisible hand?
Yeah, like a like economic term, like invisible hand, like?
Yeah. I guess I would see it as both, in the sense, I mean, clearly the name slow food resonates with, we're not fast food, we're against fast food. So it is a symbolic statement. Good, clean, and fair resonates symbolically. But it's not just about words and symbols, although it is about words and symbols, but it's not just about words and symbols. And I think what slow food is based on is the notion that if people care about food, and if people know good food, they're going to want it. Just as Daniela Cassi said, she said, people want quality food, but they don't know what it is or how to get it or even, you know, what differentiates a good prosciutto from a bad prosciutto. And so slow food is trying to fill the gap in this knowledge so that people will then go out and demand it. The question, and we were talking about this at dinner, is, and you know, this gets back to my question of middle class activism. If you have money, you can choose. You can say, you know what? I don't need a 20-ounce porterhouse steak. I'll eat a 6-ounce or a 4-ounce steak, but I'm going to buy grass-fed beef, eat less, and pay more because I want good quality food, and I don't want food that is produced with antibiotics and hormones and pesticides and all the rest of it. But if you have no money, if you have a dollar in your pocket, you're going to buy the McDonald's dollar meal because that's all you can buy. So this is my question. Can people with a certain amount of disposable income be an engine for social change? And, you know, is it going to trickle down? I mean, that's my question. If we all say we only are going to eat grass-fed beef, will the feedlots wither away? Like the state was supposed to do, remember? That was Marx's idea. You know, will this actually spread out and actually change the way that we produce food? And I don't think the jury's out on that. But I do think it's clearly, things are happening. You know, when Walmart has a big organic food section, something has happened. Walmart wouldn't do that if consumers weren't demanding it. So, you know, is slow food responsible for Walmart having organic? Probably not. But is slow food part of something bigger that has caused that change? Probably yes. Any other questions?
Slow food would play out in more urban settings, because you're talking about having farms for schools. How would that play out in more?
The biggest slow food chapter in Italy is in Torino, which is a huge urban center. Bologna has a very active one. You're going to be in Bologna. Now you know where the farmers market is. The interesting thing about Italy is the cities are all very close to the country. And even though Italy has become much more urbanized and built up than it used to be, the cities are surrounded by farmland. So you don't have to go very far. You can get in the car in 5 minutes from Bologna, and you'll be in the fields. So again, you know, Italy is unique in many ways. The fact that there are 20 or 30 or 40 different grapes in one region of Italy, not to mention the other 13. Do we have that kind of sort of autochthonous biodiversity of foods and wines in the U.S. or in other countries to build on? Do we have that kind of regional diversity? So again, one of my questions is slow food's model exportable? Because Italy is such an amazingly diverse, both culturally and biologically, agriculturally, productly, you know, it's such a diverse country that may not be an exportable model. Who else?
Carol, first off, great talk, very eye-opening. I really liked it. Question about how the slow food groups have facilitated from the standpoint of the farmers as opposed to the consumers to facilitate the process that they would need to go through to transform their production to you know, more educational, going to farmers markets, taking part in that. How has the slow food movement facilitated that process from the farmer's perspective?
Mm-hmm. One of the things they do, they have these Presidium products, like the Vaca Bianca Modenese that I showed you the picture of, the white Modenese cow, that is now labeled Slow Food Presidium. And this label kind of gives a special status to these foods, which makes marketing them much more successful, and they can command a much higher price. One of the slow food people I interviewed talked to me about this cheese that they make in Abruzzo, in the mountains of Abruzzo, that has, let me get this straight, it has rennet. Traditionally, rennet is made by having the baby animal suckle, and then you kill it, and the milk ferments in the stomach. Well, they take the pig stomach and make rennet out of the baby pig's fermented milk in the stomach and use that rennet with sheep's milk. A very unique cheese. I've never heard of using rennet from the stomach of the pig. Well, this is a kind of cheese that maybe there were 10 or 15 producers still making in the mountains of Abruzzo, miles from any markets, that was going to disappear. So Slow Food said, we're making it a Presidium. Well, now they can command, I think, 20 euros a kilo as opposed to 5 euros a kilo. So they're adding value. But again, how widespread is this? What this means is those producers can now make a living making cheese the traditional way. It means there's a market for this cheese, but does it go beyond that? So this Presidium label, yes, is helping. They're also setting up networks of restaurants that I think their latest initiatives to have restaurants promote Slow Food Presidia products on the menu. So if you go in, you say, oh, this is a slow food cheese. I know it's going to be good. I'm going to order that as part of my meal, and trying to create markets that way. You have a question? Yeah.
Is this on? I was in Peru over the summer, and I worked on a school farm, and it was supported by a group from Spain. And I was wondering if that was common for internationally supported school farms to help countries that aren't as developed.
That's a really good question. I don't know, and I'm assuming this was not a slow food group from Spain. Yeah. I suspect that the school garden movement is taking off and has a life of its own apart from slow food. I think the reason is, and there's, you know, there's always two sides to every story, but the reason is the idea is that it's holistic learning for kids. So you can have a garden and learn math and biology and botany and, you know, business, marketing, the whole thing. And that's the goal. I know that in the U.S., in certain parts of the U.S., there's been a lot of resistance to this. For example, in California, you go in, you have a lot of second-generation farmers, Mexican immigrant farmers. The parents have just gotten off the fields. They're not that excited about the kids going back into the fields because it's not a symbol of upward mobility. So there's this kind of interesting cultural context. I think for middle class people to go play in the dirt it's fun. For farm workers, it's like, I don't want to go back to that. So I don't know, you know, how successful school gardens are going to be in every context. I know in my work in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, this is an area that, you know, up until the 50s was subsistence agriculture and ranching. Today, so every family had their garden, put up food for the winter, slaughtered animals for meat. Today, you can hardly find a garden anywhere in this town. And so I said, why is this? Well, one guy said to me, he said, I think it's because gardens represent poverty. That's the past. That's the past we're trying to get away from. So, you know, culture's really important. Little plug for anthropology. You know, culture is important. It determines the context into which a school garden is coming. So maybe in the city it works. Maybe in the country people are like, well, we don't need these in the schools. We got them. We're surviving with these. Anybody else?
All right, if there are no more questions, please join me in thanking Carol Cunahan one more time.
Thank you.